Welcome to the Guardian Book Club. My name's John Mullen, and I'm talking to Sebastian Barry about his novel, The Secret Scripture. Sebastian is, apart from, of course, a wonderful writer, a living, walking vindication of the merit of literary prizes. I'm keenly aware of this. I'm one of the judges of the Man Booker this year, and yes, I know. And even my father had actually heard of that one. When people express scepticism about the influence and power of literary prizes, Sebastian is currently my vindication of their benign effect. I was on a plane recently, and there in W.H. Smith's in Heathrow Airport, next to titles and authors that you might expect, I suppose, in an airport bookshop, was a ziggurat of copies of The Secret Scripture. And I think sometimes, I mean, these prizes don't guarantee readers, but sometimes I think they trip a wire which alerts readers to, in this case, a book which, I think a wonderful thing for its current popularity, is a formerly quite demanding read, and a book also about what, for I think a lot of British readers, will seem a only half familiar and quite perplexing part of 20th century history. And maybe prizes do have a kind of way of sort of introducing such adventurous material to a wider readership. And I wanted to start, if I could, Sebastian, with the history, actually.
Well, it's interesting you say that about, because specifically Dr. Green is that strange creature. He's a person who's been brought up in England and is English in every way, and yet has Irish origins. And he himself points out in the book that in England, you're taught absolutely nothing, usually about Irish history, or just a little bit, tentatively skirting around a few things. But in Ireland, of course, we're taught everything about English history. So there's this strange gap. And in a lot of ways, you're writing into that very gap that you're talking about. Because an Irish person, it's, since we are islanders and we share this space in the sea, you're always singing up to the north of Ireland, which is strangely detached and attached, and also across the sea to this other island, to try and somehow, you're actually singing across the sea and singing across the gaps as well.
And when you, I mean, we were, Sebastian and I were talking, or Paul Mann was sitting while I talked about about my father was Irish, and I remember my mother, who was from Hertfordshire, once saying to him, "Well, no wonder there's so many wonderful novelists and playwrights who come from Ireland." And my father said, "Oh, is that because of the word of a love of language and the wit?" And she said, No. You've got all that wonderful history of resentment and prejudice. What fantastic material!" But do you think there's anything in that? Is it material which sort of calls out for fiction in a way that novelists from other countries would be envious of?
Well, I think a very interesting thing has happened in Ireland since we've given up so many things in a curious way. We've given up resentment, I think, towards supposed oppressors and that view of history. You know, the 19th century was a long struggle, not only between nationalist-minded people and the seemingly British people in power, except, of course, most of the officers of that empire were Irish. But it was also a struggle between constitutional nationalists and physical force nationalists. And almost by tricks of history and also by large amounts of courage, the physical force nationalism prevailed. And indeed, in the moment of its first victory in 1916, it was the beginning of the total disregard and banishment of that long struggle of people in the Irish Parliamentary Party, like Redmond, all through the 19th century to get home rule. So since those days, since somewhere in the 60s and 70s, we gave up on that idea of history in a sense, when people like Roy Foster started to write history and go back, and we realised that, you know, we didn't have things just to forgive of other people, but we had an immense amount to forgive of ourselves. And even we've gone past that now, and I think there's a sort of hunger. I mean, I suspect there's a hunger in Ireland, I hope it's true, for even dark stories that you, in a sense, told against ourselves to be retrieved. Because, I mean, this is just a tiny story, and it's a tiny book, and it's just one writer doing it in his room, as it were, but this is just a story about a particular sort of woman whom you cannot blame the English for her fate, or anybody else, or the Americans, or the Eskimos, or the people of the Faroe Islands, or anything. No, it's something we did to ourselves after independence. We gave these, you know, in other circumstances, probably wonderful young priests all this power, and naturally it corrupted them in some way, and they moved upon people in this fashion and literally removed them as if they were something obscene, literally, to be removed from view and put them into these institutions. And maybe 20 years ago you could go back and sort of accuse, but there isn't that resentment anymore. There's either an indifference, maybe, as there always will be an indifference to history, and that's a way of living as well. But where there isn't that indifference, there is a sort of passion, not for history, but actually to bring the past into the present as a sort of completing picture, or a richer picture, dark as some of the things are. I think that's a huge change, and it's part of Ireland, I think, being a grown-up country, rather than a country struggling, you know, with all those ambiguities and horrors and wonders and acts of courage that are involved in trying to make a country.
But I mean, that the thing you mention about the priest who's convinced that because he's seen Roseanne on a hillside talking to a man who's not her husband, that she's some kind of pathological nymphomaniac. I mean, he's one example, but the plot in several ways in the novel depends, doesn't it, on people's problems about sex and Mrs. McNulty, who we discover late on, has sort of made up for her own troubled, shameful to her sexual history by becoming a sort of a fury, really,
yeah.
and sort of revenging this upon the narrator of your novel.
And as you say that, you're speaking about my great grandmother, because one of the curiosities of all these books is that they have sometimes true people. I don't know what real life is or what real people are, because sometimes people in books are realer than real life. But there was such a woman whom I knew. She was my great-grandmother, but she lived into her 90s, as did her husband, who had been the band leader in Strand Hill, the first of them, and then his son, who marries Roseanne, is also in the book. And there's nothing, for instance, there is a letter at the end of the book from Jack to Roseanne, and it lays out certain things. And the curious thing about that letter is it's all true. It's actually the history of my great-grandmother. So, you talk about plot. I'm not a creature of plot, in a sense. What I do is, I really am like the child who comes into the dark wood and is quite frightened sometimes of not finding the path out and is simply trying to smell his way back to civilization in a book. And I'm always very surprised by what happens in the books. For instance, if anyone's read A Long, Long Way, at the ending of the book, I won't say what it is, but it took me by surprise and I was very shocked. And I had been telling my daughter the book as we went along. She was only 11 at that time. I used to go up every evening and tell her because I was so surprised always. And I needed to tell somebody because I couldn't be ringing my poor editor at Faber every day. So I was going up to my daughter and I came up at the end of that book and I was very upset. And she said, "What's wrong, Daddy? Because it's terrible to see your father upset." And then she was crying and I was crying. So we were crying for this fictional great uncle in her room. But it is like that for me.
Well, can I ask you, perhaps you'll say there is no answer and that it was one of the mysteries in the book which is left to be mysterious, because I know there are some of those. But there are also ones that there are answers to. And one of the mysteries, answerable or not, is about the fate of Roseanne's father. And as reading the book for the first time, this much preoccupied me, I must say. And perhaps partly because also it has a relationship to another novel by you, The Whereabouts of Aeneas McNulty,
yeah.
About a man who...
Yeah.
who and the idea, and the mystery, I suppose, about whether her father, how he died, and whether or not he served in the police force.
Yeah.
And there's this extraordinary passage where she remembers visiting the graveyard where he works for a time, and he's testing how, in her recollection, how whether a hammer and a sack of feathers will fall, which will fall faster,
yeah.
or whether showing her fall the same.
Yeah.
And then later on, it seems to be revealed that actually this is a scrambled recollection mm-hmm. of something terrible, not something charming,
yes.
which is his murder,
yes.
his in revenge by Republicans,
yes.
and that the feathers and the hammer have performed a different sort of function yes. in the story.
Yes, but even more worryingly, Dr. Green is quoting from Father Gaunt for
yes.
that. And then, because it's in the other room, the account. And then when he goes back in to look at it again, he realizes that Father Gaunt doesn't mention hammers and feathers.
Yes.
And then Dr. Green has to wonder, did she say this to me years ago? And I'm now after putting it in. And that really has a bearing, too, upon the book. And the whole issue of psychiatrists and patients for me. I mean, my mother, who died while this book was being written, was an incredible woman and a great actress and a kind of epic figure. And a wonderful grandmother. And we'd had a bumpy childhood, there's no doubt about it. I was just going to say, well, actually, she was in therapy for about 3 years, my mother. And at the end of the 3 years, probably telling things like this, but at the end of the 3 years, her psychiatrist had a nervous breakdown. So, and I'm not certain that Dr. Green doesn't have the same experience, but perhaps you can tell me better.
I mean, thinking about plot in a more expansive way, I know something lots of people here will be familiar with. One of the not unprecedented but unusual things about the secret scripture is that it has relations to other novels by you. And I hadn't read The Whereabouts of Aeneas McNulty when I first read the secret scripture, but then I did, and I found it slightly took me aback at first, actually, that. Not, it wasn't just that here was a character who had plays a peripheral but very important role in the secret scripture, but actually certain key things like the night he spends with Roseanne is in the earlier novel. Mm-hmm. And Roseanne's sort of strange seclusion or ostracization in this metal hut, that's in the earlier novel as well.
And the people are in the earlier novel, and it was written exactly 10 years before the Secret Scripture. And, I mean, that is another confounding element, another difficulty for me, because if you look at the episode as recounted by her of him spending the night, it's radically different
yes.
to the third-person account of Aeneas' experience. Which is kind of a further acknowledgement that the act of remembering, in a sense, is the important thing. It's the impulse of the remembrance. You could say in Ireland, we've had our share of wicked remembrance, but we have our share of benign remembrance. Dr. Green, as you may remember, says, I mean, you were asking earlier about the father, and Dr. Green definitively proves that more than likely, through his friend Percy,
yes.
the father was a policeman.
Was in the police, yes.
If you can trust those records, yeah. which I'm not so sure, because the records of the RIC were very poor as well.
Because I took that as an uninformed, but poorly informed English reader. I took that slightly as official truth.
No, Irish people would not be particularly aware of the history of the RIC, but unlike the soldiers in the First World War, this was not something we grew up on. Because the RIC were the people of the previous administration, and they were demonized in history, and yet so many people had people in that force. But anyway, Dr. Green says that he realizes that what Roseanne is writing is possibly factually attackable, or you could say it's not true, but that he prefers her untruth, which for him radiates health. And in a sense, the book is about mental health. Mm-hmm. To Father Gaunt's truth, which he doesn't respect. So that's what he's taking from it. And it's, in a way, it's what I take from it. At school, if there's Irish people here, you remember, I mean, I'm 53, and when I was at school, and I was in England for a few years, so I did have the experience coming back and trying to learn to be Irish, or else I was beaten up in the schoolyard. You know, in school, we were taught that all of Ireland was a sort of story. We were taught about the Fir Bolg, the one-eyed people who were in Ireland, and then the Fomorians and all. And that was all taught as if it was history. And these were ancient Celtic stories. And even more wondrously now, we're told there were never any Celts in Ireland, so I'm not sure how those stories got there. But history was taught to us as a series of stories. And of course, gender-driven. As part of that enormous effort to create a country, you needed history to go with it. So this kind of immaculately national history was written. But, you know, we have the right now, we've sort of earned the right, I think, to all our histories. And it's actually wonderful fun, apart from anything else, to go back and try and get them. I put a had the wonderful experience last year of putting a play into Canterbury Cathedral, which is a wicked thing for an Irishman to do, although the Dean did explain to me that the priests of Canterbury were in fact Catholics and they'd gone around the Reformation. I think you should have had a press conference the very next day. But this was set in the 16th century and it was an Irish play again. And it was again about the old English, as called in Ireland, the Normans. And, you know, people say they became more Irish than the Irish themselves, which is a way of forgetting about them, because, of course, that isn't true. So it was incredibly exciting to go back and try and think what those people, you know, all these lost Irelands, some of them not prioritised by our history, but now is time to go and get them back, I think.
So is that, I mean, your interest in history and also your use of stories and possibilities from your own family history, are those the reasons why you do this, why the characters in novels are kind of connected and related between, because I mean other novelists have done it purely out of, you know, Trollope used to do it just out of, he only had limited resources.
And he had to.
But he's not, and he wasn't doing it in any particularly exploratory way. It was more.
Well, you would get a hold of six huge, you know, I love particularly the Phineas Finn books.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously an Irish book, an Irish character. In fact, Roy Foster called his son Phineas. And I love all that. Well, when I met my wife, Ali, in about 1985, I had been writing a lot and I had published books and I had, but I hadn't quite, I'm an Irish Catholic, she's a Dublin Presbyterian. And somehow the experience of seeing into her world, this world, this group of people who were told after independence they weren't Irish, and what that did to them, and how they turned in a rather beautiful way and became very family-based and had their own sort of radiating culture inside this other disallowing culture. And, you know, a lot of people were enabled by independence too. This is just these little anomalies. But it also set me to thinking about my grandfather, who'd been a major in the British Army in the Second World War, the son of these asylum people. And I thought he was a strange person. I loved him, but I thought what he had done was odd. And whereas my other grandfather, who was a nationalist out in 1916, that was much more. We'd been taught that was all right. But this set me to thinking about this, what that was. And then you start to think about these people and you think, well, what did my grandfather do in the Second World War? One of the things he did was he diffused bombs all over southern England. I think it's such a beautiful job for an Irishman. And you know, he did these great things that are hidden because, you know, he bravely went in with his men and they did those, you know, in the films where everyone is it the green wire or the red wire? And they did all that, you know. And it's having access not just to, you know, the mistakes or the shame or the difficulty, but also the sort of glory and to some degree the glamour of these people who've written out. So I have written about members of my family, but I've had to make them up. Because they were completely hidden and not spoken of. So I've invented family, and in a terribly culpable way invented history, a sort of a history of Ireland. And I get a bit worried when people say, you know, oh, that's wonderful because I didn't know anything about history. And I think, God, I don't know anything about it really either. And I've made it up. But in a sense, made up history is all the history we've ever had. I hope that's not too horribly shocking for an academic, but there's a truth in that, especially Irish history. You know, it's elaborated upon a feeling often as well.
Can I ask you, because I'm about to sort of throw it open to the readers, but you mentioned the ending of the novel, and I think I should ask you a bit about that, because there's been a bit of discussion of it, and because we are in the Guardian Book Club, we don't have to do this weird thing that gets done in the of actually not saying what happens. We can say what happens, can't we? Yeah. You can say what. And actually, if you look, I think it's not a factitious thing, because I did have a kind of look on some readers' groups' websites, and they do, when they talk about the secret scripture, they, you know, here's a little transcription I just got this afternoon. I don't mind the ending, says one person. The occasional tie up things a little too neatly is okay with me, especially when the book is written as well as this one is. Then the person B replies, I don't mind tied up ends either, but coincidence is that big? Come on. Person three joins in. No, it wasn't a coincidence. Have a look again at how Dr. Green came to be at the hospital. And you know, these arguments go on. Was the fact of Dr. Green actually being Roseanne's son, was that the A Clair C Small that came on you that you mentioned earlier? That was it, and it just...
Yes, and because I'm just a human being and because I'm in the midst of life, it came on me. It's something I've tried to get at in the little piece for The Guardian. When my mother was unwell, and we'd had a relationship in the theatre, I had written for her, And we'd been wonderful friends from when I was young. And but she was a working actor. You know, you don't see much of a working actor. In those days in the Abbey, you were rehearsing in the afternoon and playing in the evening. So your mother was a visitor to some degree in your life and came and went. And that creates a certain dynamic, I think, in childhood. And that is not a complaint. That's just how it was. And I was privileged to be her son. But when she was very unwell, and this was a woman who was unkillable, in a sense. You couldn't make her sick. She'd never been sick in her life, and she had become assailed by this thing on the heart and all the rest of it. I was writing this book, and I think in 89, if I'd written the book, I probably would have had it just as Roseanne's voice. And in a sense, Dr. Green, as you beautifully pointed out in your piece, finally is the reader rather than the writer of the book. And he was never intended to have the same interest of Roseanne, not by any means. Mm. If you look at the book structurally, there's 200 pages, because I counted them, of Roseanne. 50 of 60 of Dr. Green's pages are about Roseanne. And then there's this stuff about his wife, and then there's the ending. But when my mother was that ill, Irish hospitals are quite medieval. I had no idea, actually, they were. But you have to wash the patient's clothes, the family washes the clothes. I don't know if that's medieval, but it didn't sound likely, but when they said it to me. So it meant you had to take somebody's clothes 2 hours away and wash them and fold them in a rather Yeatsian way, and she was a great fan of Yeats's plays, and then bring them back, and then give them to her, and then take the dirty clothes and do it right. And as I was making this journey, particularly one day, around the time of this moment in the workroom, I came back from, that's like a 4-hour journey, and I came back. I was coming into the house and Ali was saying hello, my wife, and I turned around and got back into the car and she said, "What are you doing?" And this is what really is Dr. Green at the end of the book when he has to come back quickly from England. I just had to go back across the city and go into the room and just make sure she was there. And it was something to do with the fact that when I was a child, that was the person of safety. And that it was kind of reversed, but in a way what it did make me feel was that she was my mother and I was her son and I had forgotten. And it also brought me back to the moment when I saw first, went up to the asylum in Grange Gorman with Ivor Brown, who was a great psychiatrist in Ireland. Everyone's ringing up poor Ivor and saying, "It's you, Dr. Green, it's you." And he's saying, "Why, certainly not, I was there." Well, we went up to this asylum and we came into this room of women. The asylum was on fire. I've talked about this before, but it was on fire and we came into places that I would never usually see. And I remember this great room of women, and they were of all ages, and they were very quiet for some reason. And there were some older ladies and middle-year ladies and young ladies, and they were all lying in the beds. And the city was aflame below with its ordinary electrical lights, and the asylum, a wing of it was burning, so people were being moved around. And I looked at those women, and I thought, no one, and I assumed nobody came to see them. This might have been a false assumption, but I assumed that. And I thought to myself, here are the grandmothers and mothers and sisters and cousins and valuable souls of the city lying here all unknown, unseen, for God knows how many years, some of them. And I thought to myself that my relationship with all those people were intimate, and that the only way you could relate to supposed mental illness is by considering yourself to be a close relative of these people. It was just a sort of moment, and that produced a little play called The Steward of Christendom, which was about Willie Dunn's father, that was done in 1905 here in the Royal Court with Donald McCann. And in a sense, it produced this book. And I am also thinking of, do you know, the African Eve, and all our DNA goes back to one woman, that this relationship is more everything, more ubiquitous than we realize. You know, we are sons to many thousands of mothers and vice versa. And all those things were coming in upon me as leading to this moment in my workroom, where I thought that this was. But I understand, I mean, in a way, the response to the ending, because this started immediately the book was published, usually stated in the midst of a, you know, a beautiful review, and there might be an objection. You know, I understand, like Gall, when we were taught at school, I see the response to the ending is divided into three parts. There's those who love Roseanne, and I won't say love the book, but love Roseanne and forgive the ending, and nice Christian way, like the Dean of Canterbury. There are those who love the book and love the ending, thank God. And then there's, I hope, a smaller group, but, you know, I respect them infinitely, who have liked the book and then reject the book because of the ending. And I have puzzled over this, and I've even gone back to it and looked at the ending. Even with my editor, we had a sort of war cabinet meeting about it, me and my editor, and
just see what this was, why this was so, and was it something to do with what I spoke about earlier, melodrama, and is that what it seemed like, and is it something to do with angels? But for me, the nature of the ending is set up in the very first thing she tells about her father's anecdotes that are keeping him alive. He sees this Indian scarf salesman racing his motorbike, and he's lifted over a wall, seemingly by his wings. And there's other moments where Roseanne seems to have a shadow of wings. And there's a, I mean, I am an agnostic person, but I'm intensely interested in angels, and indeed Catholicism is intensely interested in it. And it's a suspect interest. But in a way, I became more and more engrossed in this tiny character of John Caine as a possible final author of the book. That in fact, he is the hidden author, unknown to everybody else, even to me. And for that, he has to be a sort of angel. And I can cover it in some way by the psychosis that I suspect Dr. Green of at the end of the book, because when the asylum is demolished, he sees John Caine as an enormous angel, and he looks at his companions and thinking, do they see this as well? He is literally seeing things as people under psychosis do. So he may well be on the edge of a nervous breakdown. But anyway, I cannot imagine any other ending. I could imagine a sort of posh, get-out, smoothly ending. I could imagine her becoming unwell. And maybe this is why I didn't go here for this ending. I could imagine Dr. Green going for a conference and not sleeping with somebody. That'd be good. And then hearing she's unwell, coming back, having that conversation about blamelessness. And then in the way people do, she dips again and she dies. This is the thing I was trying to avoid, since my own mother was unwell at this time. And then out of grief and acknowledgement of what she was to him, he goes out to Strand Hill and he finds the rose, and he finds the sport, and he takes it, taking something as if something that did not belong to him, which I still think works with this current ending. But that's kind of the posh ending. But this is a Dickensian ending.
Victoria, I mean, it's funny, I was thinking about people's readers or critics, perhaps, discomfort at coincidences and sort of, I don't know, Jane Eyre, you know, he tries to get into a bigamous marriage, she's distressed, she leaves Thornfield, she runs, she travels in a sort of delirium of despair across the Midlands of England. She finally troops up some lane she's never been, miles, hundreds of miles from anywhere she knows, in the pouring rain, she falls unconscious next to a house, isolated house, and it turns out to belong to her long-lost cousins, who actually introduce her to the fact that she's got a fortune.
What is that? What does that remind you? That is a dream. That is how we operate in dreams. And fiction, to a certain degree, when you're writing a book, because I was a bit afraid of these, some of the detailed questions, because often I don't remember. Because you're in a sort of dream state doing it. I mean, you're very attentive. It's also a form of concentration. But you're working so hard. I had read a lot of Dickens, because I was writing a little play about Dickens and Anderson, but specifically a lot of Anderson, who also goes in for these strange endings. And I realize that they've become debased, if it is debasing, because my mother was in an Irish soap opera for 20 years, if that is a debasement of the form, which I don't watch these soap operas, but I've looked at EastEnders now, and yes, these things do occur in EastEnders, I notice it, you know, that they're valuable things, because they're something to do with dreams. And what I wanted, I suppose, for the book at the end was to lift off into some other realm that wasn't to do with whether she was telling the truth, which wasn't to do with Father Gaunt's harder facts, that wasn't even to do with Dr. Green, and in a sense wasn't to do with the book, that the book would just rise up and sort of disappear into impossibility. You know, it's literally what I was looking for. And to do it really, really quickly, as if I was telling you the book sitting here, so quickly, because the ending moves very quickly, which some people have also complained about, or noticed, let me put it that way. And it's moving quickly because I'm finishing a story and I'm telling you like a tall tale or a wonder tale at the end, which I have to tell you quickly because you won't believe me if I tell it slowly. And it's fatal to go back over it. But in a novel, you can just go right back and get it, you know. Because in a sense, these are all oral books. Because when she says you don't know about Ennius Macnulty yet, what she's saying is that I'm saying it to you, but in fact she's writing it down. So in a sense that, you know, it's orally, it's like a story told by the fire. I mean, it's as small as that and as big as that.
Well, I've gone past my allowance, Sebastian. So is there anybody here who would like to ask a question, berate Sebastian about his ending or anything?
Yes, just by sort of way of explanation, the point you were making earlier on about the history of this woman and the system, etc., of course, that is a hidden history, but it's a hidden history here too, and not many people know that. But what I want to ask you was, some years ago I heard a famous American historian, whose name I now can't remember, saying that myth was very strong in the United States because it had no history. Obviously, the Wild West is the greatest myth that they've manufactured. Whereas myth was not very evident in, he said, England, because it was so rich in history. And I'm wondering what you said about Ireland being rich in myth, but also because Ireland is rich in history. I mean, you may not agree with this historian, but I mean, do you think that's, is that kind of a, does it buck that rule that he's laid out there?
Unlike proper myth and maybe proper history, which should be available in all its guises, we were literally given access, well, just at school, I suppose, to one particular set of myths and one particular history. And maybe, I don't know, is it, we care about history in Ireland because in a way we're so afraid of it. I mean, even the collapse of the economy has risen up like a demon in people's minds as a piece of bad history. How did that happen? It was all true. It was an illusion that you could put your hand through the Celtic Tiger. It was only, you know, like Laurence Olivier in a hologram on the stage of the National. There was no substance to it. But for these people, say in the Secret Scripture, what's interested me right from the beginning, I wrote a play in 1988 called Boscardi's Boys, which kind of was the first of all these things. And their myths aren't Cuchulainn. These are two old brothers living in the Cork-Kerry border. Their myths are not Cuchulainn and all the rest of it, but they're the pictures that they saw in the Flea Pit in Killarney. So it's Charlie Chaplin and the Marx Brothers that is their body of myth. And for these people, well, I mean, I have photographs of these people, and they're all dressed in Sligo in the 30s and 40s as much as they possibly can to look like people from L.A. You know, probably three times a week, they went up to Between the Hedges to the Gaiety Cinema to see all sorts of things. My mother's god, I mean, probably after Yeats, was Fred Astaire. And when she was a little girl, she was put up on a table, her straight black hair tortured into ringlets, to do Shirley Temple. Her mother used to make her do it for her visitors. I mean, I'm sure my mother enjoyed it immensely. I wouldn't have enjoyed it so much. You know, these are the founding myths of a certain sort of Irish person in the west of Ireland at that time, and nothing was impinging on them as powerfully as that. But therefore, you have to give it that weight. Do you know, that it doesn't mean, oh, well, that's, you know, it's not literary myth or anything. That is such a powerful informer. And to see pictures of my grandfather, Jack, in his beautiful coat and the leather collar and the trilby hat sitting on the fender of the proper sort of car you had in those days with the Irish weather blowing him off. You know, that's an eye-opener. So that's as important to me as... Just to say, seeing Jacques Tati as a child for me is as important as anything else. The founding myths of Englishness, I mean, what would they be? What puzzled me recently, especially when I was in Canterbury, was here we have a place called England, which is Angleland, which is the land of the Angles. And I, just in the last few months when I meet English people, I say, who were the Angles? Do you know anything about the Angles? No. Nobody knows anything about the Angles. The whole country is named after them. If it was Ireland and the country was named after these people, we would have written endless books about them. We would have had plays and films. We'd be sickening you with stories of the Angles. And maybe that's a sort of cultural difference. I don't know.
And then there's a gentleman at the back.
Hello. I really enjoyed the book, so thanks very much for that. You write very movingly about grief, and I was wondering, why did you choose to make Dr. Green a widower?
Well, I had no plans for Dr. Green whatsoever, nor indeed to a certain degree for Roseanne. He had his own plans. I mean, I wanted him to write about Roseanne only. That's what I wanted him for. And he... I mean, literally under your hand as you're working, he was concerned with these other things and they were intruding on him. Some people, some readers have not warmed to Dr. Green, which I think is fine because it's Roseanne's book. And I always feel a little bit sad when they say that because he's slightly autobiographical. You know, they say he's not very interesting or he's this or he's very dull or he's very finicky or he's kind of anxious, he wants everything explained. And yes, I'm a bit like that.
Yeah, it's a question about voice, really. At the beginning of your talk, you referred to the novelist as a singer, which I was kind of interested in. And it's something English novelists would find quite difficult to narrate in a singing voice. And yet one of the things that I've greatly enjoyed about your novels is the fact that they do sing. To what extent are you trying... to create a real voice for Roseanne? This could actually be her, or is it in some ways a kind of operatic voice or almost like a Shakespearean voice, you know, in blank verse or something?
Well, I think that's the perfect answer to a very difficult question. I mean, Shakespeare, as you know, is all in modern spelling. I was fascinated years ago to find out that Shakespeare used archaic spellings and archaic words in order to make his stuff look old. And this is now completely invisible to us because we just think it's all this difficult old language. But in fact, he was consciously using archaisms to give this effect. Now, I'm not quite doing that, but there's something of that maybe going the other way. Something happens in the workroom that I actually don't know what it is. I think it's something to do with being a human being rather than literature or being a writer. There's a sort of thing in a Homo sapiens sapiens, and maybe a Homo erectus had the same thing. Maybe Australopithecus was of this nature, or is so old, it predates even the leaps we've made, supposedly leaps. And, you know, that's what it is. There's a quality to language when it's spoken. And then we write everything down. Of course, we're one of the few, we're very recent cultures who've done that. Mostly it's been repeated and learned off and carried from generation one to the next. And I think there's an element of that in this sort of work.
Sorry, I just wanted to ask a little bit about, I suppose, the sort of tension between you talked a bit about your own life history and how that relates to the story. And there's also a very poetic theme running through it. So there's literary tension between the literary story and the poetic thing. So how much of it is poetry and how much of it is a novel? How much of it is a mixture of both? I don't know. It's interesting because I think the strength of it for me is the poetic nature of the novel and how you sustain that through the number of pages.
Well, I had difficulty at the beginning of, about June 2006 when I started it. I had a chapter that I'd written in 2003, and then maybe I had three pages. And then the months were going by, and I was going into my workroom every morning and feeling more and more stupid and more worried about Faber and the contract, nice contract I had with them, and how unhappy they were going to be when I had to tell them that I couldn't make this happen. And I didn't make it happen, because what does happen is that eventually, and we live in this old stone house in the middle of a garden, in the middle of on a mountain, and there's a lot of wildlife and there's robins in the tree. And eventually you hear a sort of whistle tune for the book. And a book is written every day. You know, it's like a life lived. You can't live a life, you have to do it day by day, or you recover from addictions day by day, something similar in that too. You're listening for this tune. And it's something to do with the person speaking, that you're listening for so hard that eventually you hear it. And then you're trying to be faithful to that. And the devil take the hindmost, and you pay no heed to anything else. And you write it, and you're consumed with that. I mean, sometimes it does make you a little crazy in the head, I think, in the evenings. And, you know, if you had a knife, you might cut your ear off or something. You know, I can understand all that sort of extremity of... Because there's a fierceness about it, because it's hunting, maybe you're trying to capture something, and maybe you feel so lucky that you can keep hearing the voice every day, and then that goes on, you know, for a year, and you come away from it, and it, in a way it's over, you know, because a book nowadays when it's finished it sits for a year, your editors, wonderful editors, read it and they send you notes and you do some work on it, and there's this long period when you're no longer writing. And it is like a period of mourning, because you've had this experience. You've been somewhere. I mean, I've just been to Beijing and seen the Great Wall, but it cannot compare, in a sense, to the sort of strange luck of hearing something and being able to do it day after day. And if I talk about it anymore, the gods will surely strike me down.
I very much appreciated and enjoyed reading your book.
Thank you.
There was one scene that I read over and over again. And for me, it was an operatic scene. It was the scene where Roseanne was on the beach and the noise of aeroplanes coming up over the beach. And for me, that was an operatic performance. I wondered what the origin of that. Had you actually heard or
This is an interesting question, because it touches on fact and what you're feeling in the moment. I read two things that in a way released me into the book. One was that during the Second World War, De Valera, when one of the IRA men, active IRA men, his erstwhile comrades, you might say, killed an Irish policeman. He was so worried that this would foment again trouble in Ireland during the Second World War. He was desperately trying to stay neutral, which was a huge effort that he made. And Churchill criticised him for it and condemned him in his victory speech. Churchill, whom I consider the great man of the 20th century, but anyway, that did happen. He brought, De Valera brought over Pierpont, or one of the Pierpoints, because as you know, there were two or three generations, to hang this man. He brought over the imperial hangman, or the imperial executioner, to Ireland. It was such a huge thing to do. And I was looking at this written somewhere going, oh my God, my God, my God. And then the other huge thing was, see, if you're from the north of Ireland, you know these things. I'm an ignorant middle-class boy brought up in Monkstown by the sea in the south of Ireland. Was the bombing of Belfast, where this incredible crown of conflagration was dumped upon the city. And the whole heart of the city was aflame. And the people fled out from it. And all the people, in a way, that unionism had neglected, you might say, or let's not say it as precisely as that, that the times or history had neglected, fled out in front of the flames and into the farms. And these were people who had almost never been seen before, like my women in the asylum, suddenly seen. And the children were so wild in a sense that they were peeing on the floors. You know, they said they weren't house trained. And the farmers were horrified. You know, all these nice, upstanding Presbyterian farmers were horrified, although they brought the people in and they helped them and all the rest of it. So when I was reading that, I was going, oh, my God, you know, these incredible things. And then Sligo, amazingly, is only 30 kilometres from the border. And one of the first images I had was that, was Roseanne standing. And we, in fact, when we did a Costa film, this beautiful film that this beautiful filmmaker made, tiny film, we had her, a girl dressed as Roseanne, on the beach. And immediately, my God, with these huge, this great sea of waves behind her, it was incredibly affecting and poignant. And then I thought of those airplanes, that huge noise coming bearing down, the Second World War, that she didn't even know what it was, passing her. And these were the men, also human men, returning from the bombing of Belfast. And that was my image of her in a history that was not, in a sense, affecting her, but was affecting the rest of the world. That was, and I had it in the summer, in May, which is our summer. It's our only summer. There was a review in the paper, a brilliant review, but taking me to task for the fact that this happened in the winter. The German bombers could not possibly have got home because the tanks weren't big enough if they'd gone that way. And I thought, oh dear, I must read more. Then I discover, I'm reading it again in the panic, there were two bombings of Belfast. The second one was in the summer in May. And furthermore, they don't even know how the German bombers got up to Belfast. What they think they did is they came to Dublin, where there were no anti-aircraft guns, followed the railway line up to Belfast, dropped their bombs, and had to come across the border, possibly not as far as Sligo, but somewhere like that, and come back down through the Republic because they wouldn't be shot at by anti-aircraft guns. So, you know, in a way, if you trust those operatic images or those huge images that you so need to have and you pray to have and you try to live your life as well as you can to get them, you know, they lead to a sort of innate factuality that fascinates me.
I work in adoption and we have a lot of Dr. Greens trying to trace their birth mothers very often back to Ireland. And whether those searches actually end up in a reunion and whether it's happy or not, the tragedy for both parties is the loss of time. That's one of the tragedies. The other tragedy is what you mentioned about the indoctrination of Catholic women in small town Ireland. But it's that loss of time that's significant. Now, obviously, in the novel, we're reading about that loss of time as we go along, and I wondered how far you attempted to actually have the two characters have a conversation about that loss of time.
Oddly enough, that's actually, you know what it was? That's so intimate to me. That's such an intimate thing. In a sense, I feel that you couldn't research that no one on earth could know what that is except the people who've endured this separation. I have to say, as a son, I mean, I haven't seen my father for 20 years, and we're completely estranged. And my mother and I, in the last few years, became very distant. I was only able to go as far as I went with the book because it was only when she became ill, in a way when she had to have me there, that I was able to reconnect with her as a son, as it were, coming out of a slight version of being orphaned. And because, to tell you the honest truth, when I came into the hospital the first time, she said, and she was dying, or she recovered again, but she said, "What are you doing here? Do you know?" So what on earth are you doing here? And there was all this stuff that happens, and there was something of that in this hesitancy. I would have written it gladly. And if I was in rehearsal and an actor said to me, "Please write that scene," I actually think I couldn't possibly write it. Maybe in 20 years, I mean, you who have worked with this, and I'm only suspecting about this incredible area of human experience that is, that in some ways in Ireland was always put in a halfpenny place. Because who were these women? Well, these were worthless people, apparently. But for me, Roseanne's greatest crime, and the only thing that survived her, actually, apart from her being a piano player in the band, was her beauty. She was a beautiful woman in Ireland in the 30s. What an enormous crime. What a dangerous thing to be. And they put this adornment of the human world, of Irish life, into this place to get rid of it. You know, so they're worthless, and you take their proper clothes off them, and you diminish them, and you exhaust them, and you put things into them, and you do things to them, and you're allowed. Doctors, quite respectable doctors, even like Ivor, can go in and give them lobotomies, clitoridectomies. You can do what you like. It's like a huge Guantanamo in the 30s. And so therefore, I would say the fear of Roseanne would be that if her son was ever to be found, that he would not think she was.
Well, there you go.
There you go.
I'd just like to thank Sebastian for coming over from Wicklow just to see us, which is what he did.